I'm Harry Glerkian, and this is Moneyball Medicine, the interview podcast where we meet researchers, entrepreneurs, and physicians who are using the power of data to improve patient health and make healthcare delivery more efficient. You can think of each episode as a new chapter in the never-ending audio version of my 2017 book, Moneyball Medicine, Thriving in the New Data-Driven Healthcare Market. If you like the show, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review at Apple Podcasts. Home base for my podcast is in the Boston area. It's one of the world capitals for biomedical innovation and the digital revolution in healthcare. So I don't have to venture far to find great guests. But obviously, Boston isn't the only capital for biosciences innovation. This summer, during a trip between surges in the coronavirus pandemic, I finally got to go back to where I grew up, the San Francisco Bay Area. And while I was there, I got a lesson about the considerable impact created by one particular Bay Area institution, namely the Stanford School of Medicine's Biomedical Informatics Program, or BMI for short. BMI trains students on how to use and adapt computational methods like machine learning to solve hard problems in biology and medicine. And a remarkable number of BMI alumni have fanned out into the world of life science startups. On today's show, you'll hear from three of them. We'll talk about the work their companies are doing now and how the skills and connections they picked up at Stanford have played into their careers. The first guest, and the person who helped to organize the group interview, has actually been on the show twice before. His name is Andrew Radin, and he joined me in November of 2018 and again in August of 2020 to talk about his Palo Alto-based company, Aria Pharmaceuticals, formerly known as Tuzar. Aria uses a collection of proprietary AI algorithms to discover new small molecule drugs for a range of diseases. In traditional drug discovery, years can go by between the identification of a new drug candidate and the testing of the drug in animals. Radin says Aria's AI can reduce the time to just weeks. Andrew kindly recruited two of his fellow Stanford BMI alumni for our conversation. One is Peyton Greenside, the co-founder and chief scientific officer at Big Hat Biosciences in San Carlos, California. The company combines wet lab science and machine learning to make it easier and faster to design new antibody therapies. And again, the leap forward is that Big Hat's rapid cycle of antibody design, synthesis, and characterization vastly speed things up, reducing the time required to identify new therapeutic antibodies from months to just days. And our third guest is Tim Sweeney. He trained as a surgery resident at Stanford and then founded a company to tackle one of the biggest problems in acute care, namely how to diagnose infections faster and more accurately. The company is called Inflammatics, and it's building a diagnostic device that emergency departments and outpatient clinics can use to rapidly analyze messenger RNA in patients' blood to screen for sepsis and other kinds of infections. All three of these companies are benefiting in different ways from the computational methods their founders studied at Stanford. And they've got some great stories to share about how their time at BMI convinced them that future progress in medicine and drug discovery would depend on data above all else. We originally planned to meet up in person for this interview, but we switched to Zoom at the last minute out of concerns over the Delta variant. So without further ado, here's my talk with Andrew Radin, Peyton Greenside, and Tim Sweeney. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to today's show.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have all of you here. For everybody listening and watching, we were actually supposed to do this in person, but unfortunately, the Delta variant sort of threw a monkey wrench in that whole process. So I reserve the right that we can do this in the future and actually get together when this whole thing is over, like normal human beings. Each of you are working on super exciting things, different companies focusing in different areas. So if, you know, and I know you all know each other, so I'm going to step back one second and say, If you had to give a brief description of your company, or, you know, pretend you don't know each other, we're at a cocktail party, and you're going to give me two or three sentences about what you're doing and why it's interesting, you know, how would you sort of do that? And Andrew, since you're the ringleader that sort of helped bring this group together, I'll throw it out to you first to sort of get going.
Well, that's a lot of pressure, but so our description, I think, is pretty simple. We are a preclinical stage pharmaceutical company, and we happen to have a proprietary artificial intelligence platform that's discovered all the assets that we have under development. And these days we have 18 programs, 18 different disease areas where we've got new experimental medications, and we are working on progressing those new inventions to the clinic and ultimately to FDA approval.
Peyton?
Exciting. Hi, everyone. I'm Peyton, and one of the co-founders of Big App Biosciences. And our mission is to improve human health by making it easier to design advanced antibody therapeutics. So we actually do that through a combination of a high-speed wet lab and machine learning techniques in order to very iteratively design and improve antibodies until they meet unmet patient need. And it's been a lot of fun, and we've been founded since 2019.
And finally, Tim.
Thanks for the opportunity, Harry. So Inflammatics was founded about 5 years ago, spun out of Stanford, along with, of course, Arya and Big Hat. We are designing novel diagnostics focused on acute care and critical illness needs. So we basically have data analytics platform that allows us to decode certain signals of gene expression within the immune system. And then for those of you watching, I'll show you, we have a cartridge that allows us to sort of implement that in a 30-minute point of care diagnostic setting. So our particular focus is basically bringing precision medicine into acute care settings, the hospital, the clinic, the ICU, where sort of historically there hasn't been a lot of diagnostic innovation.
Interesting. It's funny because I wrote a textbook on how to commercialize novel diagnostics a few years ago, because, you know, unless you've been through the ringer, you may not know all the different pieces. But you guys now all know each other. Now, that may not surprising because we're in Silicon Valley, and I'm actually in Berkeley right now, but that's close enough. And drug discovery companies and tech companies are all swimming around each other. Your connection is a little bit deeper. I mean, you guys all went to Stanford together. So this is not necessarily a commercial for Stanford, but it's that's pretty interesting that three CEOs of data-driven, you know, healthcare companies out of the same class, whoosh, come out of Stanford. So how did you guys meet at first?
Well, and I would say we're not the only ones. It's just, you know, the people that happen to be in front of you today. It's funny. So right before this, I sent a panicked email because I didn't want to say something that wasn't true. I was like, Peyton, you were in this class, weren't you? To which the answer is yes.
If I was Andrew's TA, or because we'd all actually met in the same class. So I think our Stanford journeys all started, it sounds like, the same year.
About the same time. Yeah, I think
Time. Yeah. And we all were taking translational bioinformatics, which was a course taught by, I believe, Atul Butte, who I think, you know, really brought to fame the idea of big data for biology, what you can draw out of very large data sets and drawing insights. And so we were all in the same class and with many other people, as Andrew said, and it was a lot of fun. I think it was the start of, I think, you know, now I guess long journeys for all of us in a similar vein.
Yeah, and it was a place where just like, I think what was awesome about that class, again, not to be an advertisement for the coursework, but it was. To, you know, kind of my characterization of the class was you basically learned how other people use data science to solve some medical mystery, like across the spectrum. And so the purpose of learning all that was to just kind of fill you full of ideas of things that you could do. And then the capstone of the class was, you know, a final project where you basically had to come up with something, right? And so you were just sort of primed with all this like super interesting sort of research on how other people had approached like very different problems in the space. And for me, it was just the source of lots of interesting ideas that then, you know, helped me ultimately create was the technology behind our company today.
It is remarkable how much came out of Stanford Biomedical Informatics, though. I mean, to Andrew's point, there are a number of other CEOs that came through in that sort of in a several, maybe 5 or 7 year stretch, all out of the same program. And I think a lot of it had to do with that, you know, yes, this one particular class had all the different applications of data science sort of across the spectrum of life sciences, but they also attracted people like that, right? I mean, everyone on this call has a very different background before Stanford BMI. And I think that was part of what made that culture so special, is that it ends up being a real team sport, whether your background was medicine or business or math or computer science or bioengineering or anything else. And sort of that, you know, learning a technique from A and applying it into area B, I think, is a pretty successful way to grow innovation.
I feel like a venture guy, I should be standing at the exit door and just sort of saying, you know, what's your idea? And screening as they're coming out the door.
Some folks have also become venture capitalists. Yep. So you can add
that to the list. That's true. Yep.
So was there anything in particular that you guys like, you know, interests or questions or discussions that you sort of bonded over that sort of brought you together? I mean, even as just friends that decided to keep in touch?
Well, I think it's probably different for different people. I think the first real interaction I had with Tim, you know, the details escape me because this is almost 10 years ago now, but I remember, like, he's a medical doctor, right? He's got a MD and a PhD, if I'm not mistaken. And so I'm a hardcore computer scientist. That's my background. And so back in those days, I was rapidly learning all I could about medicine and biology. And I don't remember the topic, but I do recall him, you know, helping me after class with something that wasn't just quite, you know, sitting in my head correctly. And remember thinking, like, what a nice dude to, like, you know, kind of take some time and give me, like, you know, a little private tutoring. And then if I recall afterwards, he said, yeah, so I'm trying to do this stuff with some clinical data. Can you help me, you know, with this sort of stuff, which if I remember correctly, I never actually helped you. I remember talking about how I might be able to help you. And then eventually you said, I figured it out. I don't need you.
We were trying to build a web scraper. And I said, I have no idea how to.
Oh yeah, totally done that. Yeah, I've done that lots of times. So that's how the conversation started with Tim, is sort of, you know, I think to the point about having very different backgrounds. You know, with Peyton, I don't really recall the first interaction. I remember we were in a journal club maybe with Russ and you were talking about some stuff, but I think the more I got connected to her was around the time she was working on her defense and actually went to her PhD defense. And I have this this BS detector that sometimes goes off a little early, right? When people make a statement, I'm like, I don't know about that. And I remember sitting in her defense, and every time she said something that made me, you know, do one of these, like, wait a minute, kind of stuff, she instantly resolved it in the next sentence. I was like, okay, all right, that's cool.
Oh, that feels good.
Yeah.
And so I passed, fortunately.
Well, you don't have to pass my scrutiny, obviously. But yeah, I think that led to a number of, you know, kind of interesting conversations as she was contemplating, you know, what to do next. She was moving through her career. But yeah, I think that the interactions are very, very different for each person. At least that's my view, but I don't know if you guys have different memories. But
yeah, I think what's interesting, I mean, just generally, I agree with that. And I think one of the most interesting parts of BMI is, Tim said, is just the backgrounds that everyone has. And I have this, so, you know, I also come from the kind of applied math, computer science background. And there's this kind of, you know, fascination of what you can do, right, with kind of computational skills in biology. I think, to me, a lot of the conversations around, like, where do I even apply this to? I think people sort of think of computational biology as a, maybe, you know, sort of a niche small field, the intersection of maybe, you know, somewhere in where biology meets, you know, I guess, you know, statistics, computer science and math, but it's so broad and it's so vast. And I think most of the, I'd say most exciting conversations I've had are, you know, what are you in, we work in immunology, you know, you're a clinician, you work with clinical data, you know, how do you apply these tools? Like what, you know, the most both daunting but fun task upon showing up, I think Stanford was such an incredible ecosystem here, is where do you even, you know, focus your attention? Like, where should you work? There's too many exciting opportunities to pick. And I think some of the fun conversations I remember, I'm also having with Tim with, you know, more clinical background. It's like, what's actually useful? You know, I want to do something useful and sort of trying to figure out, you know, where this, you know, where you can actually kind of apply your time to the most impactful problem. It was a lot of fun.
And I think, yeah. Tim, it'd be great for you to share. I mean, when we first met, I'd asked you kind of like, what were you doing there? What your story was? I can't remember the words, but you basically said, like, look, I'm a surgeon, if I recall, you know, and my I'm trying to like save people's lives. And I'm just thinking, like, is there a better way? Can I like just, you know, do something that's going to have a much larger impact? And I don't know what that is yet. I know, wildly paraphrasing what you said, right? But like, I'm thinking about like what that could be. And I think that, you know, when I met you, you were sort of on the hunt for figuring out where to apply, you know, kind of the skill set.
I mean, I think that everyone shows up with their strengths and weaknesses. Mine certainly was. The summer before the program actually started, I had to take, you know, sort of like basic courses in computer science and linear algebra. And I remember, I mean, this, I literally went from my last overnight call at Santa Clara Valley Medical Center, running two ICUs, to the next morning, CS 106 X, which, because it was the summer, was filled with all the high school students that are just like total whiz kids. So I was saying, you know, I'm like 16-year-olds and they're like, you know, we're learning like order of operations or something, and they're raising their hands, and I'm like desperately trying to write down like O of N means, you know. And obviously Andrew and Peyton were among the folks that sort of helped me on the basic sciences side of things. But I think that the story about sort of getting the question right is absolutely correct. And I remember actually the time that I knew I was in the right program was maybe 2 or 3 months into training. I was at some, they used to have these like sort of work in progress talks. And it was like, you know, Wednesday or Thursday or something, you bring your lunch. And somebody was talking about this thing that sounded very, very cool to me. It was all about how you could program a system to learn new knowledge on its own. And it was like, you know, generalized AI for health data. And I was incredibly impressed. And the first example that was given was like, you know, so we've sifted through all of the billions of data points and I have discovered, and he stumbles over the drug name. And I've discovered that clopidogrel, which he meant clopidogrel, is associated with bleeding events. And everyone goes, oh. And I was like, you know, put my hand up, like, that's an antiplatelet medication. And he looks at me and I'm like, so the point of that is that it thins the blood. And he looks at me and he's like, So bleeding is a known side effect. Totally crestfallen. Like, people knew this already. Like, I had no idea. I was like, I do have something to contribute. So it's a good merge.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, Tim, you're running a diagnostics company. You know, Peyton and Andrew, you're running what I'll lump together as drug discovery companies. And different markets, different regulatory processes, but, you know, I'm sure there are common challenges to life science startups in the Valley. What are some of the biggest challenges that you guys see? Is it scalability? Is it finding the right people? Is it finding the right investors? Where do you guys see your challenges?
And I would just say, for a little clarification to Peyton's point about there's so many different problems, even though Peyton and I are both in the business of creating new medicines, we couldn't be any more different. We're a small molecule company. She's a large molecule company. If you know what that means, you know, like,
yes.
You know, I'm making motorcycles, she's making trucks. Like, we're just doing completely different things. And so there's, you know, I think some of the to your question about like kind of what are the very similar things, but like we're not really even competing with one another from that perspective. But I think to answer your question, at least from my viewpoint, you kind of have to do all those things. I think, you know, startups, sort of everything has to work. You can't sort of have any one thing that doesn't function. And whether that's the science or the fundraising or the team or all of those things, if you've got a problem in any one of those areas, it can be life-threatening to the company. And so I think part of the experience for the entrepreneur is sort of, you know, because your time is limited and your resource is limited, is sort of finding a best fit to try to solve, you know, or to maximize all of those problems simultaneously. You know, and I would say all the things that you've listed have, they all at various points in the company, you know, have been critical. And it's more of a juggling act rather than, geez, all you need to do is just knock it out of the park on, you know, financing and who cares about anything else? We know lots of stories where that, you know, hasn't gone well, or you knock it out of the park on an exceptional team and, you know, like the other things don't come together. So, you know, from my standpoint, all that stuff has to work, all of it.
I think my answer continues. I think one of the things many people who just find, I would say, many scientific inquiries fascinating is just what to work on or not. And I have the same problem now. You know, I think it happened when I went to Stanford and happened, you know, postdoc, and happened now. And in the context of my company, so we basically have a platform that can work on engineering any protein. We work on antibodies, but really can be anything. And so, you know, we have this basically landscape where there are tons of diseases with unmet need. There's sort of tons of opportunities for the type of therapeutic protein you would use, whether that's a standard antibody, monoclonal IgG, sort of a next generation antibody. And so we always have to decide, you know, what are the programs going to be? What are you going to go after? What's the modality? And I think, I mean, you know, that is in at the crux of it, like, you know, a drug discovery company, which is, what is the shape of your company? But our platform is so broad that basically we can work on so many things. And I, once again, find myself facing the same problem, which is, okay, like, you know, where should we focus our attention? And that's been really fun, I think, and getting more also into the, you know, I guess maybe more of Tim's background, but sort of learning more about the clinical side of things and where unmet need is and where that pairs with our technology. But I agree with what Andrew said. Nothing really can go shortchanged, but that's been, you know, the same theme, I would say, just now in a different vein.
Yeah, I mean, I think about this as a balance, right, of dynamics where you're at different stages at different points, depending on where you are in the development cycle, and you need different people, and different issues become a problem at different points, or maybe become more acute at different points. But, you know, all of you guys have one theme in common, which is why we're on the show together, is, you know, data and some form of machine learning or other, you know, part of artificial intelligence that's being applied to find something valuable or identify some valuable piece of information that can make something actionable. It's sort of a big question, but how do you employ machine learning and AI in what you're doing in each of your businesses? Because I think of these things as like I have a toolbox, and then I have to apply that tool in a very specific way with a specific set of knowledge that can feed it, that where I can get an output that I'm looking for. And so each one of you, like you said, Andrew, you're working on the motorcycle, she's working on the big truck, and he's trying to make sure that everybody gets diagnosed and not ends up in worse than they already are. So how are you, each of you, thinking or approaching this in your own unique way, if you can summarize it? Tim, why don't you go first?
Because sure. So for us, each one of our tests works by measuring a discrete number of genes within the body. It's their expression levels. So for instance, for our flagship test, INSEP, we look at 29 different gene expression levels from blood. And then, of course, we have to somehow integrate 29 different levels into actionable information. And so the back end of that is the data science part, the machine learning. So the step one is actually choosing what to measure. And then after you've chosen what to measure, then it's training hardened algorithms that turn 29 different things into a score that says, like, this person has a bacterial infection. And then, of course, doing that repeatedly, right? Doing it in a way that is traceable and verifiable, and then all of the post hoc, you know, how is it affected by different demographics, and how is it, you know, in the actual context of care? And of course, in the coming years, when actually implemented in a health system, how does it impact patients and providers, and does it save costs and improve outcomes? And maybe just to, since I didn't get a chance to answer, I think one of the questions about challenges is a lot of times sort of it changes with sort of the application that you're taking farther, right? One of the things that we all have in common, I think, is that we're all platform companies. And to Peyton's point, like, you can apply that data science platform to a lot of different areas, but each one of those areas has to be taken through a very long development process to actually help a person. And the challenges totally change along that development lifecycle.
And just for everybody listening, so you develop this product. What is the so what? What is the
impact? Yeah, I mean, in our case, we decided that we wanted to go after one first indication that would be a big enough hit to make the business matter. We've got lots of things we'd like to do in the long run, but sepsis is an area of outstanding unmet need. And the so what is, right now, if you go in and you're feeling sick and you see a doctor and you want to know, hey doc, like, do I need antibiotics? There is literally no test that can answer that question. It's a guess. So it's not to say that antibiotics aren't administered quickly, but as a physician myself, I can tell you that it's a guess at first. And then you have to wait for tests to come back, and those tests themselves are imperfect. And so something like 40% of antibiotics are probably misprescribed. And if you knew in 30 minutes, hey, this person has a bacterial infection, or you could greatly simplify care and really improve outcomes. And that's the promise. But the challenge, of course, is that beyond the data science, there's so much that goes into, you know, building the product and proving out the clinical data and getting it through FDA and then getting it reimbursed and, you know, getting it rolled out more broadly. If you want to get to the point where you've actually helped a number of people and built a solid business.
Yeah, we did it in my last company before I moved on to venture. We had a strategy consulting firm, and we did a lot of digging into sepsis. That was a big problem, that a nut that people were trying to crack. And, you know, if you could crack it, you know, the opportunity is quite significant. So now, Peyton, Andrew, how do you guys think about it? Because I'm thinking manipulating an antibody and sort of tweaking little parts of it until you find the exact fit, supercomputing or massive computing.
It's funny. I actually think that the context in which we all met, which is, you know, when I think big data was becoming really popular in medicine, is actually a great context, I think, for where Big Head ended up. And it's funny because it's been kind of a long journey. It always happens when I look back, you're like, yeah, that makes sense, right? Based on where I was. And, you know, we actually, you know, put a lot of our attention into integrating the wet lab with the dry lab component. And this is actually, you know, with a goal of making big data into what I might call sort of smart data or agile data, which is that, you know, the idea back in the day when first I would say you got tons and tons of really large data sets and you can sort of mine them, right? You can look for trends, you can sort of figure out something, you know, an interesting relationship between gene expression and patient outcome. And I kept throughout my career feeling frustrated by being handed the data set and sort of having to just mine and not having kind of, you know, ownership of being able to say, I want to look here. I want more data here, right? You're sort of handed a really large data set and you're, you know, you're now kind of like a passenger in this kind of, you know, a data set that's already been generated. You cannot modify it once it's been made. That's kind of this fixed data set. And, you know, as a computational person, that you're often the second person, like a wet lab or experimental lab is making this data and you kind of get it, right? And so, you know, throughout, I would say, especially at my time at Stanford, this was very much the case where I was felt kind of trapped in being given a data set that, you know, I didn't necessarily design, but I could sort of mine. And so at Big Hat, we're basically trying to now put computation in the driver's seat and kind of change that paradigm. We're actually now, instead of just getting one large data set you design up front, you acknowledge that biology and like science are very iterative, right? As you said, you sort of start with an antibody sequence, but you know, would you stop there? If you could just make one tweak, maybe you'd make it, you know, 10x better, 100x better with two tweaks. So how do you enable that? How do you enable that very rapid cycling? And so we view this as kind of the intersection of how closely can the lab and the computational side interact and how can they inform each other? How can you one learn from the other? And so we actually, you know, enable a computational person to design an antibody on Monday in a few days. You synthesize, purify, characterize the antibody and kind of, you know, understand, are you moving in the right direction or are you not? And repeat, and then repeat and repeat and repeat. So you don't get kind of stuck in this fixed data setting. And so this is really attractive for a lot of ways, right? There are a lot of reasons. You kind of can end up in a really good regime in this big data or sort of area, but you know, there's kind of a lot of lost opportunity in terms of being able to kind of be very agile and move towards something that looks promising and iterate more. And the goal is that that will allow us to enable kind of different types of antibodies that don't even exist today, because you can't engineer them that easily, right? You kind of are stuck with a fixed format. So it's been really fun. And so we've been spent a lot of time designing the wet lab to kind of support the machine learning side and data science side from the ground up and vice versa. And so it's a pretty unique sort of setup. And I think I like to think of it as sort of, yeah, sort of smart data, right? You're now thinking really closely about what should I generate that will be helpful and can use that to inform how you redesign the next data set and improve your antibody every time in our case.
Andrew?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the different stories. You know, I think all of us are kind of taking the approach that, you know, what data sources and what artificial intelligence allows you to do is to take real world data and then make some prediction under uncertainty, you know, with the expectation that prediction is, you know, potentially better than what you could do with other methods. And so, you know, kind of tying this back to when I was a student and thinking about, you know, where are the places I could make a big impact, was very interesting to me was very complex disease and disease where there was really no single biomedical measurement that would help kind of unravel the mystery of the biology behind that disease and therefore could, you know, explain something about pathogenesis that would lead to a new discovery or a new medication as a result. And, you know, part of that coursework in 2017 was this concept of integrative genomics, this idea of using, you know, different data sources that are all keyed to the same thing, you know, maybe a gene or a gene product, kind of looking for that overlapping evidence. And there were some great papers that were shown. There was one, I think, by Eric Lander in particular, where he was using, I think it was GWAS and some proteomics and maybe some gene expression marker data, each of which would give you, you know, like hundreds of quote unquote answers and sort of, you know, the real answers in there buried with a bunch of false positives. But ultimately what happened in this paper is he showed that, you know, sort of there was one overlapping gene in all three of these data sets. And he ran some assays and determined, you know, indeed that was the sort of the key to unlock this mystery. And that certainly worked well, you know, if all of your data sets are sort of keyed to the same thing, but that's not the reality of biomedical data sets. There's, you know, genomics measures, there's chemistry measures, there's phenotypical measures, there's different patient measures. And unless you're conveniently measuring them all from the same, you know, patient population, you know, over time, which is very expensive and very, very time consuming to do, there's really no easy way to sort of key all these things together. And my thought was like, maybe there is a way. And so the technology that I created and ultimately has been expanded upon is taking this concept, the concept of, you know, that the answer to a very complex disease doesn't necessarily live in any one measurement or any one biomedical data set. And if you have the ability to ultimately pull in lots of very diverse, and by diverse, I mean statistically independent data sets across a wide range of biomedical measures and integrate them as a single processing unit, you can ultimately uncover things that other people essentially haven't noticed before, right? And then use that in our case, you know, to do lots of things, but in our case specifically to develop new therapeutics. So in all of our disease areas, you know, ultimately what this means is we are working on new mechanisms of action, right? These are new, if you will, new concepts or new understanding of biology in these disease areas. And therefore what it means or what the impact is to your earlier statement is we're going after biology that potentially has a disease modifying effect that others have not, you know, approached before. And therefore, you know, sort of the promise of the opportunity is to make a significant dent in these very, you know, complex diseases. And so that's a, you know, kind of a high level view of what we do, but ultimately it's all about, you know, integration of these very different data sets and then using that to ultimately, you know, come up with new experimental medicine that we would, you know, explore and experiment with and see what it can mean for patient impact.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most exciting parts of when I talk to everybody. It's like, you know, assuming the system is designed well and the data going in is actually good and wow. I didn't know that happened. I didn't know that pathway was involved, or with this little, I didn't realize that tweak could make this difference. And so that's what I see when I talk to different people that are working in this area of, I just didn't know, or none of the papers talked about this, or that's not what I learned in school. And so that's the most fascinating part of these systems, where you can identify things that faster, hopefully, and more accurately, hopefully, than you might normally do with a human being. No knock to human beings, where all of them are valuable, but it seems the systems move at a different pace and can handle a much broader level of data being input into them. And so that makes me, you know, bring the question that Andrew, you and I have talked about it of, you know, if you had to put a time frame around it or something, is this shortening the time to discovery? And I think you and I, the last time we talked, you said it's about 3 years where I can shave off on the front. And then at some point when I have to get to a mouse, I have to follow the normal trajectory of that mouse. But, and if that's changed and you're finding other areas, I'd love to hear it. But Peyton and Tim, where do you see the aha, the speed or the financial impact of what you're doing? You know, you're doing it because it's moving it faster, or you're able to identify something that you haven't, but it's better than X or Y that's already being done in the marketplace.
You know, for us, actually, this is, you know, I mean, we do things faster. We do, I say, you know, improve in a lot of metrics, but it's actually, for at least my company, about designing antibodies that couldn't otherwise exist. So for example, the standard monoclonal IgG, there are many tools out there, right, to sort of, you know, I would say discover initial molecules and sort of optimize them. But you start getting into these kind of next generation or kind of Frankenstein antibodies, nanobodies that are a tenth of the size, or kind of scFvs, which are these fragments that are, you know, part of CAR T therapies or other formats, they become more complex and people have trouble engineering them. And you can kind of run your imagination and say, well, if I had the ability to engineer things, what other formats would I conceive of? Would I consider, you know, tiny, you know, I would say antibodies like cell penetrating peptides that can get into cells and sort of have all sorts of characteristics, but they're difficult to engineer. And so we actually, instead of sort of doing the same thing faster, actually think more about how could we expand the universe of what could be a potential therapeutic protein, and how could that solve current patient needs in ways that existing therapeutics do not? And we do that by doing things faster, sort of, and cheaper, and sort of more smartly. But ultimately, that's what we really care about.
I think my answer is probably somewhat like Peyton's. I think if you look at diagnostics and biomarkers in particular, right, a lot of diagnostics are about, hey, you know, we found that if you measure this one protein, that's useful for health. So it's a very, very slow process, and it's not optimized. You know, you tend to study things that are obvious because they're easy to measure. Or like in our field, there's one protein called procalcitonin that's sort of the current closest biomarker for whether or not somebody has a bacterial infection. But PCT, as procalcitonin is abbreviated, procalcitonin was discovered, I don't know, 30 years ago, and it was originally basically by accident that someone even measured it in someone with bacterial infections, and then it worked pretty well. And, you know, I mean, it's a sort of, it's based on serendipity, and it can't be improved upon. It has, you know, however good procalcitonin was yesterday, that's how good it's going to be tomorrow and how good it's going to be the day afterwards. I think the benefit of data science in diagnostics was really began with cancer. You know, when you had sort of the wonderfully successful tests like Oncotype showing how you could measure signals across complex diseases by integrating things from multiple biomarkers. And a lot of those were designed. And there again, the problem was that they took a long time to develop. And of course, they take a long time to actually run, right? I mean, most of, if you've ever had one of those tests done, it's like a week send out, you know, you send some tissue to a company, it gets processed, you get your answer 7 days later. So one of the things we're doing differently, it has to do with the way that we gather and integrate data sets to empower faster discovery. And then the other really, the ability to build new answers that haven't yet existed, sort of more like Peyton. And ultimately the hope is to create a feedback loop where, you know, better and better versions of the test can be slowly released. And so over time, it's not just that you're sort of stuck with, hey, you know, procalcitonin is as good as it is. It's like, you know, you're on INSEP version 5 in 2030, and it's, you know, now X percent more accurate. And I think that's a real benefit to patients.
I want to pause the conversation for a minute to make a quick request. If you're a fan of Moneyball Medicine, you know that we've published dozens of interviews with leading scientists and entrepreneurs exploring the boundaries of data-driven healthcare and research. And you can listen to all those episodes for free at Apple Podcasts or my website, glorikian.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. There's one small thing you can do in return, and that's to leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It's one of the best ways to help other listeners find and follow the show. All you have to do is open the Apple Podcast app on your smartphone, search for Moneyball Medicine, and scroll down to the ratings and reviews section. Tap the stars to rate the show, and then tap the link that says write a review to leave your comments. It'll only take a minute, but it'll help us out immensely. Thank you, and now back to the show. You guys have been doing this for a while. Do you see the promise of big data and AI playing out the way that you thought, or is it different than you thought? Now that you like jumped into the pool and you've been swimming in it for a while, and you know, is it fulfilling the dream you had? Is it more exciting than you thought?
It's a funny question. I think, you know, coming from very different industries, you know, looking at where I was 10 years ago, I think I was very naive in what it actually takes to bring a drug to market. And I think in the very early days of the company, you know, my prior startups, you know, one of them I was in and out in a year and it exited, right? And so there's no such thing in this industry, right, to do anything like that. And so, you know, part of it was whatever biased by my prior experience, but I think part of it as well is it's sometimes I think also hard to see how far things have moved along. You know, and I think even in Tim's description is he was sort of talking about, well, you know, this was state of the art science, you know, in decades past. You know, the work he's doing today was impossible back then, right? So,
right.
You know, there's sort of these steady incremental improvements. And I think part of what really is happening in the industry is that as the things to solve essentially are becoming exponentially harder to, you know, for example, for high throughput screening, which is maybe the old way of doing things to find a hit, or exponentially harder for, you know, sort of diagnostic tests or sort of blood tests to sort of detect, you know, these nuances, you sort of have to bring in these technologies and these capabilities that are exponentially better, you know, at solving those things. And so I think what happens is, you can therefore characterize it in different way. You know, is the time faster? Well, if, like compared to the old way? Well, of course, because those old ways just don't have a chance of being able to do these things. Like, is it cheaper? Well, yeah, because those old ways, again, just don't have a chance, you know. But I think part of it is what is the pace of innovation? And that's, I think, kind of where the rubber meets the road and sort of like what is actually possible and what's capable. And so today, you know, we talk about having, you know, 18 concurrent disease programs, and we've got a very small team and we haven't raised very much money, you know, that would just be flat out impossible 10 years ago. But now, you know, and we still like raise some eyebrows around that. But now, you know, sort of like, yeah, like, okay, we recognize, you know, software is doing a lot of what used to happen in the wet lab. So this, you know, sort of fits within the expectation of what, you know, a modern technology company would do in the space. So I think there's that other angle of kind of like where expectations are kind of, you know, catching up with what's actually been produced. And therefore, you know, at some point we become the old technology, right? You know, 30 years from now, some next generation will be talking about, oh, those slow, painful people that, you know, tried this in the past kind of stuff. And so it's, you know, each iteration of innovation has its moment in the sun, if you will. And this is definitely the time for, you know, the work that we're collectively doing.
I think the promise is ahead of us. I think it's, you know, we're in an amazing time where I think things are starting to gain traction. We're starting to get tools and infrastructure. But I think that, you know, if I were to say my conception of what machine learning and data science and generally computational power is going to do in biology and medicine, I think it's just starting. So I'm excited to see things like AlphaFold. I'm excited to see a lot of, you know, these kind of tools and capabilities be unlocked. But I think, you know, you're solving a complex problem, right? That protein that you're predicting is in a cell, and it's part of a tissue, and it's part of a human. And, you know, there's so many more layers, I think, to consider. And I think it's, you know, we're making great progress, and I certainly believe in the potential. That's why I'm here. But I do like to sort of say, I think we're at the very, very early days. And as Andrew said, I think it's going to be fun to see what happens in 30 years. So I'm still, you know, very excited, but I wouldn't say we're at the accomplishments that I would consider of sort of really demonstrating the cornerstones of, you know, machine learning in biology and medicine.
I have to agree with Peyton. I think the best is ahead of us. So one of the courses we had to take at Stanford BMI, and I don't know if you two remember this, was Mark Musin taught this course on ontologies, but part of it had to do with sort of like the history of applications of sort of clinical data systems. And the oldest one, and like, I forget the details, but it was in like the 70s, and it was around sort of, you know, clinical decision support for therapeutic prescribing. And then he, you know, obviously that system isn't around today and failed for its own reasons and sort of walks through all of the failures of systems since then. And maybe one of the most remarkable things is how little AI and machine learning is actually employed in like most clinical practice. And there are some areas where for sure, like, it, you know, an area has fallen, you know, for all the buzz around computer vision, the AI that radiologists use most is probably their dictation, right? I mean, it's, you know, it isn't yet a sort of commonplace machine assisted radiography reads. And so will that be coming? Absolutely. But the interesting challenges in each successive generation of like, oh, you know, we got pretty close, but it turned out that X wasn't good enough or wasn't built in the right way to be integrated with workflow or is coming soon, but still needs some regulatory work or whatever else. There's plenty left to do.
I think that's probably one thing we all experience actually transitioning, right, from academia to industry, where what's exciting in academia, you know, is not necessarily what's going to be reliable, right? When you really want to make a good drug. So what you might think about it, be like, oh man, that's a really cool model. Like, I'd love to try that. You know, that's great. And you kind of go right into industry and you're like, okay, well, this is going to matter. Right? This is going to go into patients. This has to work multiple times. I think it is a very different standard, right? So I actually think it's the right thing. It's just because you find something to be very, very cool and kind of, you know, I would say cutting edge, you really want it to work and you want it to work over and over again. And I think there's a, you know, an unappreciated gap between when something is first proposed or conceived of or demonstrated, and then when you can really make it work at scale, you know, over and over again in areas that matter. And so I think, you know, we're basically in that transition, right? For, I would say, a lot of these techniques in biology and medicine. You know, let's get it to work in practice. Let's get it to work in practice reliably. And now we can start sort of really seeing where we can move the needle on really impactful problems. But it's funny because I do think that's an important divide between sort of where we all started together.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I mean, look, most of our focus these days is not on discovery. It is actually in the development of the therapeutics. It is about, you know, preparing for IND filings. It's all the regulatory work we need to do that. It's medicinal chemistry. It's a whole bunch of things that are outside of the discovery process. And as we proceed to the clinic, more and more of our overall effort as an organization has, you know, less to do about the core innovation that, you know, created all of these assets, and more about the heavy lifting you have to do to ultimately get that product to market. And I think, you know, to kind of tie it back to my previous comments, I think there's been a new generation of capabilities that has been created. I think, you know, to what these guys just said, it's going to be a while until we actually see those things in the clinic. And to Tim's point about, you know, computer vision and radiology, like there's a lot of good science that's already there and has been shown, you know, experimentally to do a better job than obviously the human looking at those images. But yeah, it's going to take a while until, you know, that becomes the standard. I am, you know, my daughter was born almost 5 years ago now, but I was shocked to observe, you know, even back then, which is only 5 years ago, that, you know, medical records were being passed from clinic to clinic with a fax machine. It just blew my mind. Like, you gotta be kidding me, a fax machine? Like, I don't think I've seen a fax machine, right, in all these years. And so, yeah, I think part of it is, you know, there's if you want to take the place where innovation moved the slowest, it's certainly got to be, you know, government, healthcare, education. I'm not sure which of those might be the slowest, but there is a time for these new technologies to permeate the industry, and that is going to take time. And I think that's when ultimately patients and the people that are on the receiving end of all this innovation, like, that's when they're going to see that difference. And it is going to take many years for this stuff to kind of, you know, make its way through the process and ultimately, you know, into the hands of providers and ultimately to patients. And that big benefit is going to come in the years to come, right? It's obviously, you know, not in front of patients in many cases today.
Yeah, well, maybe it's, you know, my brain is wired towards risk or innovation, because I'm like, well, if you wait till it's done to get involved, you're way too late, right? You're going to be you're either going to be a dinosaur or you're going to be obsolete. And we've seen that in a lot of areas of tech compared to, you know, old standard industry. There was a great piece the other day about this engineer at Ford who'd been working on, you know, the gas engine for 40 years and then wakes up one morning and is like, I need to take early retirement because software and electric EV is the way it's going to go. And now I'm just in this sort of maintenance mode of what I'm doing. And I think about healthcare and I'm like, any institution that isn't at least dabbling in, you know, using image analytics for radiology or something and starting to get used to this, I think they're way behind, you know, where they may want to be in the next 5 years, because technology doesn't follow just a slow curve on the way up, right? It has a way to go straight up at one point, moving into an exponential curve. And I think the same for you guys. I mean, those companies that are not involved or partnering or investing in entities like you guys, is if you wait till it's finished, you're it's already too late, because Andrew, your system will start keep kicking out new molecules, and Peyton, you'll be making new antibodies, and it'll be a little too late to catch up, right? I mean, that's the way I think about it.
Yeah, I would temper that a little bit, and the reason I would say that is because the companies that have been successful in the past in, you know, creating diagnostics and therapeutics, you know, products are on patent, they have long life cycles, and they generate lots and lots of cash. And so, you know, big pharma, big diagnostics companies, they can kind of wait around and sort of see how things, you know, sort of shake out with different, you know, younger companies, and simply, you know, buy or acquire, you know, assuming that the companies are willing to be acquired, you know, those assets. And so I think, you know, large pharma has been very successful in becoming, you know, acquisition and essentially manufacturing and marketing machines. So
yep.
I don't necessarily think that some of these larger and established players, that they're necessarily, their livelihoods are threatened. I think they will continue to, you know, acquire the best of the best with their large cash reserves. I think some companies in this space will gather the momentum and break out. And I think in time we might see some, you know, changes over time as to what the big, you know, sort of players are in this space. But unlike other industries, certainly software, you know, it's like MySpace disappears and Facebook reappears the next day, right? And that's because you can deploy new technology and move users over in the course of an afternoon. And like from a therapeutics perspective or a diagnostics perspective, that's just not the pace at which those things move. So there's lots of room for that, you know, and maybe similar in the automotive industry, you kind of have to build a factory and build some cars. It takes some time, right? So maybe there's some parallels there, I think, in some cases, but I don't see like a wholesale change happening overnight, at least from where I stand.
Not overnight, but we definitely have to have dinner and like have a discussion around this topic, because I would love to bring some examples to the table about how I see things. Once you digitize something, the model itself doesn't have to stay the same way as it used to be. It is up for change. So I think those are the shifts that may change the dynamics of the market. But I'd love to have that discussion with a wonderful glass of wine after having come from Napa this week. I can show up with a few nice bottles. Thank you so much for taking the time to, Andrew, thank you for bringing this group together. Peyton, Tim, it was wonderful to meet both of you. I hope that we stay in touch, and I'll keep watching the companies as they progress, and I wish you guys incredible success.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. It's our pleasure.
Andrew, Peyton, good to see you as always.
Absolutely.
You too.
That's it for this week's show. You can find past episodes of Moneyball Medicine at my website, glorikian.com, under the tab podcast. And you can follow me on Twitter at @HGlorikian. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with our next interview.